The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI.
Welcome back to the deep dive. Today we are immersing ourselves in something that really shapes how we process, well, almost everything these days: images, data, how things are presented.
That's right. We're taking a close look at visual culture by Alexis L. Boylan.
And this isn't just, you know, an art history lesson.
Not at all. It's really a deep dive into power, actually. The book makes this essential argument that visual literacy, basically the skill of critically reading an image, is maybe the most crucial skill you can develop today.
Mm-hmm.
Boylan shows us that visual culture isn't just something we consume passively. It's more like the fundamental operating system through which modern reality gets interpreted and experienced. It actively builds our world.
Okay, so our mission then is to give you that critical toolkit the book offers. We want to understand what makes visual culture so contentious. Is that the right word? Yeah. Contentious is good.
Mm-hmm.
And why simply looking at something is never really neutral.
And how everything from, say, a billboard to a complex data chart is actually making an argument.
Exactly. Before we dive into the framework itself, maybe let's talk a bit about the scholar who built it, Alexis L. Boylan.
Good idea.
So she's an American academic and art historian. She's got significant credentials, a PhD. She's director of academic affairs at the UConn Humanities Institute.
Oh, wow.
And holds a joint appointment in art history and Africana studies. So, you know, her analysis carries the weight of serious scholarship.
Right. But what seems really distinctive about her perspective is that she doesn't just stay in those, like, traditional academic boxes.
Hmm.
Her work really zeroes in on intersectionality, you know, how race, gender, class, all those things interact. And she applies that lens kind of everywhere.
That's what makes her scope so broad, I think. She can analyze, say, really high theory conceptual art and then turn around and apply that same critical rigor to mass culture figures.
Yeah.
Like she did famous work on Thomas Kincaid, the painter.
No, the painter of light. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So she's not just studying beautiful things in museums. She's studying how images actually work out in the messy commercial political world we live in.
And that focus on the messy world, that connects directly to her main idea, which is actually kind of counterintuitive when you first hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Boylan defines visual culture not by giving us a neat, stable definition.
No, she avoids that.
Right. She embraces its inherent contentions, its disagreements. Mm-hmm. She even calls the book a field guide to this complicated, maybe uncomfortable territory.
And what's fascinating there is that the core insight is really about the struggle for control. Visual culture for her is this ongoing battle.
A battle over what?
Over what it means to see. What we even allow to count as visual. And crucially, who controls the power to interpret that visual world?
Yep.
So it's not about finding some universal list of great images. It's much more about analyzing the political conflict that's embedded in the very act of seeing.
Got it. So the book takes us on this kind of conceptual journey then. It moves us past just the biology of sight, right?
Exactly. It starts with vision, like your eye physically working.
The hardware.
Yeah, the hardware. And then it moves into the culturally conditioned ways we interpret that input. That's what she calls visuality.
Visuality. Okay.
And that's the key shift. You move from just passive biological reception to active cultural interpretation.
And exploring how visual things aren't just reflecting reality.
Right.
Yeah.
They're active agents. They construct our social realities. They don't just show the world. They actually make things happen in the world.
Okay, let's try and unpack that journey a bit more, starting with that really fundamental distinction you mentioned. Chapter 2, vision. She really hammers home this difference between vision and visuality.
Visuality, yeah. Or sometimes academics call it scopic regimes. Fancy term, but
scopic regimes. Okay.
But think of it like this. If vision is the hardware, the physical eye, then visuality is the software.
Ah, I like that analogy.
It's the specific set of lenses trained by culture and history that we use to interpret all that visual input. For example, think about the invention of linear perspective back in the Renaissance.
Right, making things look realistically 3D on a flat surface.
Exactly. But it did more than that. It trained Western viewers to see the world as orderly, as something you could grasp mathematically. That wasn't just an art style. It was actually a way of structuring thought itself.
Hmm. But if our way of seeing is trained like that, how can we ever really agree on what an image means or even how we're supposed to feel about it? Doesn't that just make everything subjective?
Well, Boylan would argue that the disagreement is the point. Because a vision is always a product of culture, technology, history. The only, maybe objective truth is that the experience of looking is never raw or neutral. We're always, always looking through some kind of framework.
And that framework has expanded radically, right? Especially in Chapter 3, The Visual. I really appreciated how she pushes us way beyond the museum walls here.
Oh, absolutely.
The visual field isn't just paintings and sculptures anymore. She insists we treat things like scientific data visualizations.
Yeah, charts and graphs.
Architectural plans, maps, even the user interface on your phone.
Uh-huh. And surveillance footage. That's a big one. It's all part of visual culture for her.
Because they're all doing something. They're producing knowledge or shaping how things are run.
Precisely. Think about a map of voting districts. It looks neutral, technical, but it's a deeply political argument presented as a simple diagram.
Which leads us neatly into chapters 4 and 5, The Object and the Social. This is where the stakes feel incredibly high. She argues that the meaning of any visual object is fundamentally unstable.
Yeah, it shifts. Depends entirely on the context, how it circulates, who's looking at it, when.
Okay, so give us an example of that instability.
This is where we see images doing really serious social work, as she puts it. Consider the really powerful and, frankly, disturbing case study of the Zeely daguerreotypes.
Okay, what are those?
They were photographs taken in the 19th century of enslaved people. They were actually commissioned by a scientist, Louis Agassiz, for, frankly, racist pseudoscientific purposes.
To prove racial inferiority.
Exactly. That was their original context, their intended meaning.
But looking at them today, the interpretation is completely different, isn't it?
Absolutely. Today, they're viewed, quite rightly, not as scientific data at all, but as these haunting, incredibly individualized portraits of humanity, of trauma, of resistance. Their significance has been totally contested and renegotiated over time.
Wow. That's a really powerful illustration of meaning being unstable. But if interpretation can change that drastically, how does Boylan suggest we find any kind of stable truth? How do we even agree on what an image was meant to do back then?
She sort of sidesteps the true meaning question and shifts the focus from meaning to function.
Okay, function. What does it do?
Exactly. It's less about finding some single historical truth and more about analyzing the image's power, its ability to create and enforce social realities. Images are tools, basically.
Tools used to do what?
To forge identities, to enforce hierarchies, sometimes to justify actions, even violence. This is why the whole politics of the gaze is so central to her work.
The politics of the gaze. Like who gets to look?
Yes. Who has the power to look? And who is constantly made the object of that looking? Think about the historical male gaze in art and film, or today, the pervasive chilling lens of surveillance culture.
Right. That definitely makes the act of looking feel like an exercise in power. And if images are doing this social work now, who gets to decide which images even survive to do that work in the future?
Well, that brings us conceptually at least to Chapter 6, The Archive.
Okay. So museums, libraries.
Yes, but also databases. And crucially today, massive social media platforms like Instagram or Facebook. Mm-hmm. These archives, Boylan argues, are not neutral repositories of history.
They're not.
Not at all. Mm. She frames the archive as a kind of battleground for the future. Because whoever controls the past, meaning whoever controls what gets saved versus what gets excluded or ignored.
They dictate the stories we tell about ourselves.
Exactly. And that limits the kinds of futures we can even imagine.
So creating your own archive, or maybe just questioning the existing ones, like asking why certain things are in the museum and others aren't, that becomes a really important political act today.
It absolutely is. And, you know, the book finishes brilliantly, I think. The final chapter is structured around 4 common objections people have to the field of visual culture.
Like what?
Like the criticism that it's too broad, it tries to include too much, or that it's too political.
Okay.
And Boylan cleverly uses those very objections to reinforce her main point, that the field's necessary broadness and its intense focus on power dynamics are actually its greatest strengths. The inherent messiness isn't a flaw. It's the very foundation of her argument.
That makes sense. That transition then from just passively consuming images to actively engaging with them, that feels like the real core takeaway here.
I think so.
Let's try and distill some of the major themes Boylan offers us. What are the big ideas we should hold on to?
Okay, first is that essential paradigm shift we talked about, visual culture as social construction. The idea that what you find beautiful or normal or acceptable isn't based on some universal truth.
It's shaped by history, culture, power.
Exactly. And the reflection there is empowering.
Mm.
If it was constructed, it means it could be questioned, maybe even reconstructed.
Okay, what's next?
Second, the politics of the gaze. We really have to internalize that looking is never innocent. Visual culture functions as a type of power that shapes social relationships.
So you always have to ask, who's doing the representing here? Who are they representing? And what's the power dynamic embedded in that image?
Precisely. Third is the concept that images perform social work. Remember, they're not just mirrors reflecting reality. They're more like hammers building it.
Hammers building it. I like that.
Think about the difference between, say, a family photo album that works to build kinship and shared memory versus a glossy advertising campaign that works to build a consumer identity based on what you lack. Both are actively performing social work, just different kinds.
Right. Okay, and the last one.
The fourth theme is really the whole purpose of the book, the necessity of critical engagement and visual literacy. And this literacy isn't just about, you know, analyzing a painting in a museum.
It's about being able to deconstruct a scientific graph or a political meme or an Instagram post.
Yes, to fully participate critically in contemporary society.
Boylan's writing seems really sharp, too. She captures these big ideas in memorable ways.
She really does. Very quotable.
Okay, here's one idea, paraphrased a bit, that seems to capture her whole approach. Visual culture isn't just what we see, but how we see. And even more importantly, how we are seen.
Mm, that's a great one. It adds that crucial layer, doesn't it? It emphasizes that vision is always a social transaction.
A transaction.
Yeah. When you look, you're implicitly taking part in a system that shapes the role of the person or thing in the picture, and your own role as the viewer.
Yeah.
It's relational.
Okay, here's another concept that stuck with me.
Yeah.
The idea that every image is an argument, a claim about what the world is like.
Yes. That demands we ask critical questions of everything. Even an image that seems totally neutral or objective, like a weather map or a standardized data chart.
It's still making choices.
It's using specific visual conventions to persuade you, to make a claim about reality. Nothing is just objective data floating free. It's always presented somehow.
And one more, which feels incredibly relevant for the digital age. The democratization of image production doesn't automatically lead to the democratization of image circulation or influence.
Oh, that's vital. Because it cuts through the sort of myth of social media, doesn't it?
How so?
Well, everyone can take a picture now, right? Production is pretty democratic.
Yeah.
But who actually gets seen? Whose images circulate widely?
That's controlled by algorithms, by platforms.
Exactly. By opaque algorithms and huge economic power structures. So the underlying inequalities still dictate who gains influence, who gets visibility, regardless of how many photos are uploaded.
Hmm. So these aren't just abstract academic ideas. They're tools we can use every day.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Practical tools. First, think about navigating social media. Apply these frameworks. When you look at an influencer's feed, ask yourself, okay, how is this identity being constructed using filters, poses, editing?
And then how do the platform's algorithms influence which of these constructed identities becomes super visible and influential? Who gets amplified?
Exactly. Who gets to define success visually? Second, use this for deconstructing news and political media. When you see a campaign ad or a news photograph, don't just absorb the image passively.
Look at the choices.
Analyze the visual strategy. The framing, is it a close-up for intimacy or a wide shot for context? The color palette, is it warm and inviting or cold and alarming? The perspective, are they shooting from below to make someone look powerful or using shaky footage to imply authenticity?
Those choices are arguments in themselves.
They absolutely are. And third, there's a really deep personal application. Self-reflection.
How so?
Understanding how all those visual representations out there in mainstream media, representations of gender, race, body types, success, how they influence your own self-perception. Recognizing that allows you to become more intentional.
Intentional about how you maybe represent yourself online.
Yes, but perhaps even more importantly, understanding why certain images make you feel anxious or inadequate or excluded. It gives you power over those feelings.
You know, the thing that really struck me during this deep dive was that idea you mentioned earlier, how Boylan reframes the field's supposed messiness as its actual strength.
Yeah, it's liberating in a way.
It really is. It gives us permission to accept that visual culture is always going to be complicated, always shifting, always contested, and that's okay.
And for me, the lasting, truly empowering insight is that shift in the fundamental question we ask, moving away from just asking, what does this image mean?
And instead asking,
what does this image do? What work is it performing in the world? By adopting that functional political lens, you move from being just a passive consumer
to being an active participant,
an active, critically engaged agent, someone capable of understanding and maybe even helping to shape how we all see and are seen by the world.
That's a powerful final thought indeed, seeing as an action, not just reception. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.